So, we've done it. 6 weeks, and we've taken you from Genesis all the way to the book of Revelation. Are you exhausted yet? I hope you have gotten a sense of some of the big themes of the Scripture. Not all of them, obviously. You can't do that in 6 weeks. But some of the ways that Scripture speaks with this voice that calls us to wonder, this voice that calls us to covenant, this voice that calls us to a way of life in the wilderness with Moses and the laws and the commandments to give shape to this covenant. The prophets who continually call us back to community and to faithfulness in so many ways. We got a visit from Jesus, the rabble-rouser, the one who turns our expectations and our lives and the whole understanding of what the kingdom of God looks like upside down. And then last week, Reverend Carissa took us through somebody else's mail, right? We were reading other people's mail whenever we look into those early epistles of the Christian church and here try to make sense of the context what was happening in the churches when we only have one side of the conversation. And so we looked at the epistles. And now we come to the clearest book of the Bible of all, right? The book of Revelation. You all got it, right? Well, how many of you would agree if I said the book of Revelation is complex? Keep your hands up if you think it's a bit confusing. Yes, I think most Christians would say that. It is probably, I would say, the hardest book in the Bible to access without some help. Fortunately, there is some help to get us into it, and I think it starts with knowing the name of the book. Here it is. This is John sort of ruminating about what shall I call this book, and the eye-opener, or the John's tell-all book, but it's called The Revelation of John. So first of all, if you know nothing else about this book today, it is not the book of Revelations. It's the book of Revelation, the revelation of John of Patmos, who was exiled on the island there. And he was an early Christian leader in Asia Minor. And he was writing to real churches, the seven churches that he addresses in Philadelphia and Ephesus and Laodicea and Pergamum. Those are real churches in that area. And he's writing to them in a time of intense persecution with a word of hope and encouragement. And most of us read the book of Revelation as a scary, scary book. And there's scary stuff in it. There's scary elements in it, to be sure. But it's at its heart, it's this book of encouragement written for Christians in the first century who were struggling. The revelation of St. John the Divine, or the revelation of John. Now, if you were prone to one way of reading the Bible, and the book of Revelation in particular, as a book of predictions, you would have a lot of contemporary events to, like, give you fodder for your sermon today, right? We've seen the fires, and we think of the book of Revelation as a fiery book, right? The fires out in California. Just a couple of weeks ago, we all saw that terrible earthquake down in Mexico. And we've seen an amazing wave of storms that have swept across the Caribbean. So if you were sort of inclined to read the portents and the signs of heaven and to read the book of Revelation as predicting all these things, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world. No wonder the alarm's going off, right? You might read the book of Revelation that way. And if you're coming hoping for that interpretation today, I'm going to have to send you elsewhere. There are other biblical commentators who will do that. Other pastors will do that. You can go to Google. You can go to your checkout line at the grocery store, where you will find those kinds of predictive ways of reading the book of Revelation. But I'm not sure that's the most helpful way to read the book of Revelation. And if you're going to make extrapolations, you first have to start in its time and in its place. So what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about the kind of literature that the book of Revelation is. Anyone know what it is? It's apocalyptic literature. What other kinds of literature can you think of in the Bible? We've been looking at a bunch of different kinds. What other kinds of literature have we been reading? Letters. So we've got letters, right? Poetry. There's the poetry. We looked at some poetry in the beginning creation story. When we did the Psalms a year ago, that's a whole section of poetry and song, very imaginative language. What else? Parables. And the Gospels themselves are a particular kind of writing. They're proclamations of Jesus. They're sort of biographical, but they're more than that. They proclaim Jesus with a point of view. Anything else? War. We've got the historical books that chronicle the conquest of the land and the historical books of the Bible. So we've got history in the Bible. And then we have, and I'm leaving out a couple others, but we also have apocalyptic literature. Let me just say a couple of words about what apocalyptic literature is, because you can't understand the book of Revelation without understanding at least what kind of writing it is. It arises in it. First of all, the biblical writers did not invent this form. This was a form of writing that they borrowed from the Persians back in the time of the exile. Back, remember that exile? The people of God were in exile, and they were wondering if God had abandoned them. They were in theological crisis. They had been driven out of their homeland. And so they needed big dramatic language to address that. And so they took over this way of writing with symbols and with sort of catastrophic-born literature, and they wrote about it. Now, they're writing in that time, in that way, too, during the first century, because if you thought Nero was bad to the Christians, Domitian, the emperor who claimed to be God himself, was even worse, and slaughtering Christians left and right. And so this is a time in the church's early life when they are wondering if God is still with them, just like the people in exile are wondering. So apocalyptic literature, this big dramatic literature, rises out of a time when the people of God are in crisis, number one. Number two, it depicts this battle going on a cosmic level. It's not just what's happening here on the earthly level, but there is this heavenly battle going on between good and evil, between the Lamb and the Satan, or the devil and Jesus going on. And there's all these heavenly scenes, then we come back to earth, and then back to heaven, and back to earth, all back and forth. And there is this cosmic battle between good and evil, between God and the forces of evil, God and the emperor. And then numbers matter. Just in the short passages we read today, what are some of the numbers you heard in the book of Revelation today? 666. Oh, you know the 666. We didn't read that today, but we all know that 666, which has been connected to the emperor. 144,000. Now, what do we do with a number like 144,000? I've heard some biblical interpreters say, well, that means God's only going to save 144,000 people. I think that's terrible theology myself, because 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 10 times 10 times 10. Now, the number 12, when we hear that number in the Bible, what do we think of? 12 disciples, or, and even before the 12 disciples, the 12 tribes of Israel, right? And so 12 makes us think of the people of God. That's why there are 24 elders surrounding the throne in heaven, the 12 apostles or disciples and the 12 tribes of Israel. And they are surrounding the throne up there, that level of things that are going on. So you got, that's 12 times 12 is 144. 10 times 10 times 10. 10 is the number for completeness or totality. And so if you put the people of God with completeness or totality, number 144,000 means all the people of God. All the whole people of God are the ones who are safe in God's care. So everything else is symbolic too. These, you've got dragons, and you've got women, and you've got lambs, and you've got many horned beasts, and you've got seals, and you've got, I mean, no wonder it is so confusing. We've got all of these things going on in the book of Revelation, but they don't just mean what they mean. This is imaginative language. This is larger than life language. Everything is symbolic. There's so much symbolism there, and that's where we get tripped up, because the symbols aren't always clear. Now, I want to suggest to you that, an insight into the book of Revelation that my New Testament professor taught me many years ago, and it was this like aha moment that the Bible, that this book, which had been so confusing, finally made sense. He suggested, and he was building on the work of somebody else, that we ought to think about the book of Revelation as a giant political cartoon. A giant political cartoon, which has all this symbolism going on, but it works in its context and in its time, right? We are reading those symbols 2,000 years later. Now, can you imagine if somebody 2,000 years from now tried to read this political cartoon, right? It wouldn't make sense. We all know what it means. Now, first of all, I'm not trying to make any political points today. I'm just saying all political cartoons use symbols. And a lot of them poke fun at the president, whoever is in power, right? So 8 years ago, these more cartoons would be about Obama, right, than they are about Trump now. But that's just the way you pick on the person in power through satire and through symbol. And so we know what that means. We know that that is the fact that we might be on the brink of war. Or how about this? It's not just a U.S. phenomenon. What's this mean? This is the Catalonian secession, perhaps from Spain, and trying to wedge it off of the... And it's not physically actually happening like that, right? But we know exactly what that means. There's this movement in Spain for the Catalonian people to be independent. Or how about this? You can make sense of that right away. Based on the news, what we've been hearing over the last weeks and months, right? About whether or not there was Russian involvement in our elections. And now we're finding out all of these ads that were on Google and Facebook and Twitter. And so, and what makes that cartoon work is, you know what else? What's the shape of those things? It's like a Russian doll, right? And so there's lots of symbols there. They don't have to say a whole lot for you to be able to interpret that. Or how about this? Home Despo. I like that. The healthcare puzzle gives way to the tax reform puzzle, or the Obamacare crashing into a tree with an elephant there, with a tow truck, right? We get those symbols, but try to understand those symbols 200 years from now, or 300 years from now, or 500 years from now. One of the people suggested at the early service, at the last service, that's why I ran out into my office to try to do it, was that I give you a political cartoon just from the 1800s, and you try to understand what that means without the context to frame it. You need the context. We know what that means, right? This is a recent cartoon. And it doesn't mean that old men are sitting out in the water getting wet, right? It doesn't mean that at all. It means that we have been battered by this wave of storms, right? You don't even need words for that one to make sense. Or I'm shocked to find that money has corrupted college basketball. And March Madness money is sort of the bribe money in the back, right? Or this, some of the cartoons are satirical, but some of them are somber. Get up, get up, get up. That's one take on the kneeling during the anthem. Here's another take. I'm protesting police brutality, somebody kneeling, but the scene of the police officers is during the Las Vegas shootings, right? And they are the ones risking their lives on behalf of others. So two different perspectives on the same event that's happening. So... all of which is to say, I think that the book of Revelation reads like a giant political cartoon, and to really unpack it, you have to understand the images, and part of the difficulty of understanding the symbols is not only do they come from the first century, but they're also drawn from the book of Ezekiel and the book of Daniel, other apocalyptic literature in the Bible. No wonder we scratch our heads to try to make sense. If you open it up and say, I don't get it, you're not alone. We have to work at it, and we have to sort of unpack what some of this means together. There is the coming of the horsemen, right? The four horsemen of war and violence and death. And it's not surprising that it's been captured in art so fancifully and so imaginatively. I did a first reading, first time that I've ever done this, where I sat and I read all of the book of Revelation together. I read it straight through. I've never done that before. I've always read it in parts and studied parts of it. But this is sort of what it feels like when you read the whole book of Revelation. Chaos. All these symbols happening all at once, overlapping. And I got the feeling that it would have made a good graphic cartoon or a graphic novel or maybe a Marvel Comics superhero movie, because it has that grand epic feel, or maybe like something like Lord of the Rings, because it's so sci-fi-y as well. So what's the message then? In this chaos, what is the message to the first century church, and what's the message to us now in the 21st century? Well, it's right there in that little snippet we read from one of the letters to the churches. There are seven like mini letters to the churches in this chapters 2 and 3. And to the church at Ephesus, it's a word to hang on. I know your faith. Now, you've forgotten your first love. You've grown a little dry in your love for God. But hang on. Hang on. And the one who walks among the seven lampstands, who is Jesus walking among the seven churches, he has not abandoned you. He has not abandoned you. Same thing when we got up to chapter 14. after all of this chaos and after all of what feels like the world going to hell, the world going to hell, there is the promise that God will be with God's people, and they are called, the saints are called to endure to the end, endure to the end. And in a world where we still see evil so real, this is a scene from Myanmar. The Rohingya people who are being exterminated and kicked out of their country, a country that has been their country for generations, generations, and now they're being told, this was never your home. That's a mass deportation that's happening, and a lot of the world's not even paying attention, but it's evil. It is inhuman. And it's going on right now. We need a word of hope, a word that God is still present with us. Or how many of us needed to be reminded in the last couple weeks that evil is still present in the world? We saw that another mass shooting. We saw scenes like this, and we were horrified because we could picture our own sons and daughters running from that concert, from this random violence that was enacted. That's just evil. And to see those faces and to see those, learn those stories of all those victims, we know that evil still sometimes feels like it has the upper hand. And so we need the words of hope from the book of Revelation that say, God will have the last word. And it comes to a climax when John starts talking about this new heaven and new earth, that this age that is here now, this time of devastating consequences, this devastation for the people of God, this age, this particular period will end, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. The worship scenes, the throne suddenly comes down to the people, and you can see the beautiful artwork that captures the new Jerusalem. This is how the St. John's Bible captures it. There is the Lamb on the throne at the top there, the streets of gold, if you see them there. You can't see them, but there are lots of little teeny people represented by little shapes at the very bottom of that. And then off to the right, the tree of life. The tree of life shall be planted in their midst. The river of life is planted in their midst. It's all that water that you see sort of in that image. The tree of life. So we start in the Bible in Genesis with the tree of life, and we come all the way to the end in Revelation. And there's that tree of life again, God's presence with God's people. And this is how it goes. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven, the first earth had passed away. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a voice saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his peoples. God himself will be with them. The final scene is of heaven pouring itself down onto earth. God coming to be with these people who are embattled and lost and desperate. God saying, hang on, hang on, hang on. I will never, ever leave you. For the first things have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. Friends, we worship a God whose love is stronger than death. We worship a God whose goodness is stronger than evil. We worship a God whose presence is with us, whether things are going great or whether things feel like they're flying apart for us. We are in covenant relationship with the God who will have the last word at periods of time and for all time as well. And that is good news. That's news worth carrying with you. That's the fitting exclamation point to the Bible. Thanks be to God.